Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of November. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest this hour. Barbara has been writing frequently about the Occupy Wall Street movement all over the country. She is an extraordinary writer. She is one of the few writers who has paid very deep attention to poverty in this country, and she wrote an interesting piece in August, actually, Nickel and Dimed 2011 version. This is one of her recent writings in which she spent time living the life of somebody who didn't make very much money and needed three jobs to keep going, people who sleep in their cars, who don't have enough food to eat. And she asks in this particular blog, which we'll talk about, 10 years later after the publication of this book, have things improved or worsened for those in the bottom third of the income distribution, the people who clean hotel rooms, work in warehouses, wash dishes in restaurants, care for the very young and very old, and keep the shelves stocked in our stores? The short answer is that things have gotten much worse, especially since the economic downturn that began in 2008. She is the author of Nickel and Dimed, also For Her Own Good, 200 Years of the Expert's Advice to Women, The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, and a number of other books. She has a very interesting background. Her work now settles into three tracks: journalism, general essays, opinion pieces, now blogs, and book-length projects. But she's trained in the sciences. She is from Butte, Montana. Her father was a miner, and other men in her family were miners or railroad workers. Women were homemakers. She went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, started out majoring in chemistry, switched to molecular biology, from that to cell biology, got caught up in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and was beginning to question whether she wanted to spend her life at the lab bench. She decided that she was too impatient. She got a PhD in cell biology and then gravitated into activism. She's our guest this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Barbara. I'm sure there will be many calls as we examine Occupy Wall Street and these statistics that were revised yesterday by the Census Bureau that show there are many more people in this country living in poverty than we originally thought. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Hello, Barbara. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you again, Kathleen.
I can't imagine your writing, and that book had such a profound effect on so many people, including people who are working at the very level that you described. Your writing Nickel and Dimed in 2011, things would probably be just horrifying.
I couldn't do it. And the reason is simple, that when I was doing research for Nickel and Dimed in, like, 98 through 2000, there were plenty of jobs. I could just walk off the street to some, say, big box store and fill out an application. And, you know, I'd have to be a little pushy to get it to the attention of the personnel director, maybe. But I could get the jobs with no experience. Now, those jobs are hard to get, and you'd be competing with not only people who might customarily have had these low-wage jobs, but also with people who were, you know, maybe quite highly educated, but who have been bumped out of the white-collar workforce. So I couldn't get, you know, wouldn't work.
Right. We had news, more dismal news yesterday. The census figures were revised, showing the number of poor people in this country hit a record 49 million people, or 16%, in the year 2010.
Yes, wow. But you know, the measurement of poverty has always been a very sticky issue. For years, we were relying on a measure that was devised in the early 1960s, which was based entirely on the cost of food. You know, it's just whatever you spent on food, they'd multiply by three and say that's how much you need to live on. Well, you know, different things have crowded out the centrality of food in the family budget, like the high cost of housing and health care. So it's time, it's time that we had a revision to understand something about how many people are really, really having a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the struggle goes, you know, way beyond that 16% too, to, you know, people who may be making, $60,000 for a family of four, but facing, you know, just impossible medical bills, college tuition costs, and so on.
Yeah. And also the gap, and we keep doing shows on this, and I think it's quite significant, and you write about this as well, this gap between the young and the old in this country, the young people who graduate from college and can't find jobs and have these enormous debts and are putting their lives pretty much on hold until they're in their 30s.
Well, and I don't see any reason to think things are going to clear up when they're in their 30s. But, you know, I've always seen, you know, there are these two real problem groups in our society among people who would traditionally have been thought of as middle class, too. I'm not talking about chronically poor people. But one is the young people who are graduating from college with an average debt of $25,000. And really very little possibility of a job that will help them keep up with that student loan. The other group that is in a lot of trouble is the people, is say, from about 50 to 65, or 62 even, whenever Social Security clicks in. But there's, you know, in that group, it's almost impossible to get another job because of age discrimination. It's, you know, it's just about hopeless. If you've been downsized from a white-collar technical or managerial job at the age of 50, it's, well, you know, that may be the end of your working life, but you're not recognized as elderly enough to need any benefits until you're in your 60s, 65 for Medicare. And that's a pretty desperate group.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Occupy Wall Street. You've been writing about it frequently. You have written in 2008, you went all out for Obama, bumper sticker, lawn sign, T-shirt. But if he can't take a few minutes from his 2012 campaign to rein in the occupation-busting Democratic mayors, most recently in Denver, he's not even getting my critical support this time.
That's right. You know, I don't expect much from him at this point. There have been so many disappointments to those of us who were his, you know, enthusiastic supporters in 2008 that I really, you know, I'm lowered my expectations drastically. But when you see Democratic mayors like Gene Kwan of Oakland, who's, I think, by this time come around a little bit, or the mayor of Denver, bringing in police to crack heads in occupations, then you think, geez, you know, can't he just, like, get on a phone and say, guys, we're all Democrats, and we know that the occupation movement is coming from very sincere grievances and impossible life situations, so let's not greet it with police violence? Would that be too much to ask of the president?
So why do you think that he's staying away from it?
Oh, well, I think it might have something to do with his fundraising for his 2012 campaign from Wall Street. You know, there's that's sad, but I can't think of what else.
The other thing that I keep asking this question, so I'll ask it of you as well, Barbara, is this disconnect between what many, many people in this country are feeling. They can't find jobs. They're underemployed. They've got debt. They got to pay for college. They're putting their lives on hold. They can't find jobs when they're in their 50s. The jobs that they had, the benefits, et cetera, have been cut. They're not keeping up with the cost of living. The cost of living keeps going up. And nobody seems to be paying a lot of attention to this. And so the people who we elect to go to Congress don't do anything. It's as though they're not realizing what people are experiencing in this country right now. And I don't really understand why they don't take some action to make lives better.
Our elected officials?
Yes.
Well, But, you know, finally, since September 17th, when Occupy Wall Street began, these problems are visible, have been made visible by protest.
Mm-hmm.
The people that I have met who are occupiers, and you have to be, I think, pretty hardy, you know, strong kind of person to sleep outdoors, especially as it gets colder.
Right.
I've just been struck by how many of them are like college graduates now earning $8 to $10 an hour in entry level jobs, like in retail, or are people who have been foreclosed on, people who thought they were in the middle class, and very interesting, homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
Who have been increasing in numbers, of course, in the last years of economic downturn especially. So this is what we're seeing in the occupations is the face of American economic misery. And, you know, it's beyond me why an elected official can't see that, why he or she is not tuned into the polls that show a majority of Americans supporting, or being fine, sympathetic, since we have no particular demands to talk about, sympathetic to the occupation movement. What's with our elected officials?
Well, in many ways, it's not a very radical idea, is it? It's people who want to work and make a living so that they can put food on the table, and they're not asking for much. Give us a job.
Yeah. I think some of them would ask for far more. There are discussions that go on, you know, all the time in occupation sites about how society could be better arranged, better organized. But, yeah, basically, people have taken this drastic step. And to me, it does seem like a drastic step to live outdoors on the hard ground, often without toilets. And they've taken that step because they just felt, I can't go on like this. Come to the end.
What do you
mean? Can't pay my debts, can't get a job.
Right.
Homelessness is the next step anyway.
What do you make of the criticism that these groups are rather amorphous? They don't have a list of demands that they need to be asking government for an increase in the tax on Wall Street. They need something more than just their presence.
Well, I don't think some of the quote demands that they might want to make are any mystery, because liberal economists, for example, have been saying the same thing for a long time. For example, that we need to start taxing financial transactions, taxing, that is, the casino economy on Wall Street. If the private sector isn't generating enough jobs, the public sector should generate jobs itself in vital areas like infrastructure. So, you know, it's not like there's some big mystery. How do you solve these problems? I actually think it's a good idea to not try to narrow down to a list of 10 or so demands, because that just invites so much potential dissension. You know, I've been involved for a long time in, like, the women's movement, and, you know, we could waste, and this is in the 70s, we could spend days trying to hammer out our principles of unity, and at the end of that time discover we didn't like each other anymore. we didn't feel very unified. So I think this seems fine to me.
We had a guest on yesterday, a political science professor at Hofstra, who is of liberal persuasion, who said that for the first time in many, many years, he feels hopeful because of these protests. Are you filled with a sense of optimism?
Yes.
You are.
Yes. I am not known for optimism. my last book was called Bright-Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Undermines America.
Right.
I've never been on the side of, let's, well, we just have to be optimistic about everything. But I've been feeling something peculiar at And I realized this is hope. This is hope that there might be really serious change finally.
Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest this hour, and we're going to be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. One of my favorite books of hers is Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, which is a very strong piece of investigative journalism in which she put herself in the position of getting jobs, and they were, she just said, available in those days that were low-paying jobs. She needed three of them. She had to live in her car at some point. It's really a good book. And that was 10 years ago. Now she couldn't have even written the book, she says, because there aren't any jobs. She's our guest this hour. She has paid a lot of attention to the Occupy Wall Street movement. We welcome your calls. Our lines are filled, but keep trying. You'll get through eventually. You can always use the email. I'll get to those as well. talk@wpr.org. The phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your calls, starting with George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. Pleasure speaking with you, Mr. Ehrenreich, longtime admirer. I'm wondering what you think about when I hear the 1% cry all the time. You know, it seems to me that probably setting our sights too low or too high. It's really, I think, we really need to do some serious distribution of a larger group than that, perhaps the top 10% or 20%. Your thoughts?
Yes, I see your point. And I don't think that to divide the American public into one unit and then 99 others really is much of a class analysis. But the 1% brought this on themselves. They did isolate themselves increasingly over the last couple of decades. They presided over the companies that downsized and really threatened the security of any kind of middle class here. They presided over the lowering of pay for many blue-collar workers. They did isolate themselves. They became very visible. They've been flagrant in their consumption, certainly in the last few months as they got over any kind of hesitations caused by the recession. They're back to buying, their airplanes, and they have a new emphasis now on what they call hyper-luxury, the old luxury not being quite enough for them.
Hyper-luxury? What's that?
Well, I had to ask I had to read things like Women's Wear Daily to find out. It's a bag, a purse, a woman's purse.
Oh.
That costs, $10,000, $30,000. It's because you want everything to be kind of handcrafted and individual and so on. This is not a world I know about.
Mm-hmm. George, thanks for your call. Mike in Crivitz. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Excellent show. I'll give you a little silver lining. The country is very diverse, so I can't address what's going on in the cities. I'm heading out west. I'm in the energy field. And I think what happens to a lot of young people today is, number one, they don't have any money skills. My daughter just graduated from the University of Oshkosh with $4,500 in debt after working 5 to 6 jobs. She's the first person in our family ever to graduate from college, and she hooked herself up a really good job. Now, I'm in the energy field, and I'm heading back out to the Dakotas. Now, I'm not saying that's for everybody, but I can guarantee you, if you were a single guy right now, you could get off that line in protesting and come out to North Dakota, and we'll put you to work for $30 an hour, and that's just trying to train.
What do you do, Mike? What's your job?
Well, first of all, the president is doing a terrific job. He's really got our coal business going. And in Gillette, Wyoming, Williams, North Dakota, Bozeman, Montana, we have a lot of work out there. And the only what's holding the president back is the Republicans. I think Obama is just one of the best presidents we ever had if you're in the energy field. But Obama believes in rolling up your sleeves and getting to work. I'm all in favor of helping the truly needed, the truly poor, and those who are less fortunate. But Obama is not giving a free lunch to everybody, and that's what they all expected.
Barbara.
I just have to wonder, Mike, can a woman get one of these $30 an hour jobs?
Pardon?
Can a woman get one of these $30 an hour jobs?
You bet they can. I can tell you, you can walk into Williams, North Dakota tomorrow and go to Taco John's and not know anything about anything and make $15 an hour. I'm not saying it's the greatest thing in the world. I'm just saying that there are opportunities there that the president is trying to get. And the same people, a majority of them, in these Occupy Wall Street, when we try to get our energy jobs open, they're the same darn group protesting, no, you're going to ruin our environment. You know, I don't get it. I really don't. I mean, we all have to work together. And I'm from a rural area, so I don't know what goes on in Oakland, and I'm sure those are all different areas. But I can tell you right now that there are opportunities, and God bless the president that we got.
All right, Mike, thanks very much for the call. Off to North Dakota, Barbara.
Yes, spread the word.
I guess so. Chrissy's telling me that I didn't see the show last night. There was a profile on an NBC show last night, a profile of a North Dakota town where there are a lot of jobs. They had 500 truck driving jobs, I guess. And I guess there are little pockets in this country where jobs are abundant, but not everybody lives in North Dakota, right? You want to live in Cribbets, Wisconsin, maybe.
Yes, you might have children. It might be difficult to relocate. And then when we all start relocating to North Dakota, believe me, the wages will go down fast there.
Yeah.
But the sad thing is, when I'm listening to Mike, is that was once, you know, what many blue-collar men especially could hope for. Get a good union job. I don't know if his job is union, but you got a job, you know, like the men in my family traditionally were miners. They weren't paid very well, but, you know, they knew if you worked hard, you could get a job, and you might even get advanced in it. That's no longer true, though. We're deindustrialized as a nation. Those jobs are gone, you know, in mining, in steel, in so many industries that, you know, manufacturing.
And whatever happened to a movement, I remember the president standing at the bridge in Ohio to rebuild infrastructure in this country. I mean, that's kind of it's not a partisan issue, really. It would put people back to work, would it not? And it is needed, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, the tragic thing about the situation is that we have very high unemployment, but we have no shortage of work that needs to be done in this country. The infrastructure is one of the most glaring examples. But it's also, you know, in the human services, we need more school teachers. We need smaller classes. We need more home health care aides and things like that. You know, we don't have a government that can say, all right, if the private sector can't see a way to do this and make money off of it, we're going to step in and just create these jobs.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Good travels. And we go to Linda in Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Kathleen. Great program.
Thank
you. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi, Linda.
I favor the Wall Street picketers, and I think a lot of the elderly are just living on their Social Security. And I think this whole thing is to benefit the super committee to pit the young against the old, and it's to take the emphasis off the real problem, which I think is why the richest 1% that has about 30% of the wealth can't pay a higher rate of individual federal income tax.
I completely agree, Linda. And I don't think they're going to be too successful at pitting the young against the old in this. You know, if you go to one of the occupation sites, you would be amazed at how many people are elderly at these places. I'm not sure that the elderly people are the ones who stay overnight, especially if they do have a place that a home to go to. But it's very mixed by age.
Thank you, Linda. Here's an email from a big supporter of yours, Barbara, from Stephen Madison, who says, thank you for having such a wonderful guest on. And a broad question for the day and perhaps for the guest, what can be done to foster the next generations of Barbara Ehrenreichs?
Oh, dear.
That's a good one.
They're out there. I do not feel very lonely in the last few months, and I certainly think there are plenty of people who are, you know, also like me, writers and, you know, perhaps you could even say intellectuals like Naomi Klein and Joseph Stiglitz and Michael Moore, who have been, and Cornel West, who have been, you know, in the thick of it. And so this is not a lonely business. And I like the fact that there's just so many folks, like people I grew up with, or the, you know, the people in my extended family, who are also out there who are not celebrities.
Joshua in Richland Center, hi.
Hello. I find this very fascinating. Ever since I was a young boy, as young as I can remember, I had this sense of inequality around me. I was raised by a single mother, and the biggest concerns I had was, are we going to be homeless? Are we going to have heat? Are we going to have food? So I had this ingrained in me at a young age. And life is a journey, and it's an adventure, and you got to be adventurous. When college came around, it was an interest to me, and I went back to those questions. How do I get food? How do I have a home? And the two biggest things that people spend money on are homes and mortgages, when it doesn't have to be that expensive, and food. So I decided to start a life as being a permaculturalist and working with food systems so I can grow food, harvest food, live on very little. I make less than $3,000 a year, and it's due to the fact that I'm harnessing resources, but instead most people want to pay people to get those resources. So as we foster new people coming into the sector, as they age and become adults, we should be focusing these people onto the fields and into the woods so we can start supplying food and firewood and products from nature that makes them understand that if we don't take care of this, economy doesn't matter. It's ecology, and we're running out of resources. And
all right, let's go to Barbara. Barbara.
Well, I think that's admirable. I'm sitting here wondering, wow, he lives in 3,000.
3,000, I know. What if you got sick?
You know, you are a role model. and I think that's the kind of thing we have to be talking about and exploring. And I think that's the kind of thing that comes up in conversations around the occupations in different cities. How are, you know, should we go back to a more subsistence sort of economy? That is, you know, with more emphasis on people producing for themselves.
Thanks, Joshua, very much for your call. It would be hard on $3,000 a year. if you had something happen to you and you had to go to a hospital, what are you going to do? You're in debt,
yeah,
right?
And I think with children, it would become very dicey.
Yeah, pretty impossible. Jim in Stevens Point, hi.
Yes, good morning. I think we're missing a big point. We're dancing around the issue. I see the issue as how to separate the incestual relationship that Congress has with the big corporations, and I'll give you a brief example. Most of the money that was spent in TARP didn't go to shovel-ready jobs. Over $4 trillion has already been given out by the Federal Reserve to big banks, and what are they doing with it? Nothing. When Henry Paulson was the chief executive, first of all, Barney Franks and Christopher Dodd changed the whole atmosphere as far as lending was concerned, because there was this big push that everybody could own a house. So anybody that could fog a mirror essentially seemed to be able to get a mortgage on a house. Henry Paulson was the chief executive officer of Goldman Sachs, and he came up with these exotic lending instruments, and we had the housing crisis that we have. And we found out that Christopher Dodd was a beneficiary of Countryside Mortgage, that he got special loans and so forth. So we have this incestuous relationship between members of Congress and big industry, particularly big banks, in which all this money went to the big banks.
Barbara.
Yes. No, I think that you put it very well. This is what the word for this that I think we should have to start using in this country is corruption. You know, when the political process is controlled by the wealthy in order to make themselves more wealthy. We don't like to use the word corruption about the United States. We think that's something that goes on somewhere else. But no, that's what we've got. We've got a political system that is so corrupt that, you know, I'm running into more and more people who say it cannot be fixed. Now, I don't know how to feel about that. In some way, my heart drops when I hear that. But they're saying we really have to start from some very basic changes if we're going to get the money out of politics and restore anything resembling democracy.
Well, we've gone quite the opposite. Look at what's happening with elections right now. We're in a nonstop election season in Wisconsin, as they are in other states. But the amount of money being poured into television ads is just unbelievable, and we ain't seen nothing yet.
Yep. Yeah, no, you're right. But if what they don't realize, I think, the political class and their wealthy backers, sometimes they're the same people, is that the level of disillusionment in this country,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that so many people have begun to say, what is the point of even voting?
Right. Yeah, there is a lot of that. But you just said something really dramatic that you're hearing. If it cannot be fixed, then what?
One of the things I have heard in the occupation movement is that we need a kind of grassroots democracy, such as they practice at occupation encampments around the country, where people meet and will resolve things by consensus. Now, that sounds just great to me. That's my ideal of democracy. I do not know, though, how you take that model from a group of 200 people in an occupied encampment to a country of, 300 million?
I don't know.
You know,
sounds good to me.
The problem of scale obsesses me. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? Now, maybe there we could harness technology to make that easier, because we certainly don't want to spend all day in General Assembly meetings in our neighborhoods and around our blocks to talk about every possible issue. So we have to create forms of democracy. But right now, I think it's... The first thing is just to challenge the corrupt powers at the top. Just as in Egypt, I don't think they thought maybe as much as they perhaps could have about what was going to come after Mubarak.
Right.
But they knew they had to get rid of him.
Yeah, but they sure didn't think long and hard about it, because look what they have now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Jim, thanks for the call. Alex in Menominee, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Alex, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I hate to say it, I actually do kind of disagree with the Occupy movement for a couple reasons. Now, I believe that America, we have the right to succeed and the ability to fail. I think a lot of people have gotten a lot higher up than maybe they deserve, and a lot of people have been left out. Now, as far as the jobs thing, I think that there are plenty of jobs. I'm actually a truck driver. There's something close to 75,000 available jobs that are between 50 and 70,000 a year. I think a lot of the problem is that some of the jobs that are available are undesirable, and a lot of people don't want to go into that sort of field. But I just don't think it's fair to expect the 1% to pay for our mortgages and pay for our college loans. I just don't think that's the right way to go about it.
Barbara.
Well, I don't think anybody is expecting the 1% to pay our daily expenses and things. I think what my expectation would be is that they stop trying to make money off of every single thing we do. Have you ever looked closely, you know, like at a telephone bill?
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that something?
You know.
No.
A fee for this, a fee for
right.
that. You don't know what these fees are.
Right.
Well, all of these, all of that is what goes up to the 1% eventually. Bank fees, fees to cash a check, you know, it's everywhere we turn. College loans turn into, you know, that, now that, that is a huge kind of debt pile up, now bigger even than the credit card debt in this country. Everywhere you turn, you're confronted with somebody trying to rip you off. And that, you know, we finally figured out that that isn't, you know, muggers on the street. That's the guys who run the banks, who run the finance industry, you know, who have been profiting so obscenely in recent years as other people have fallen into poverty.
What about his point, though, that there are thousands and thousands of jobs out there? It's just that people don't want them. It's beneath them.
Well, I think that the jobs that people don't want that are beneath them do not pay in the range that he's talking about, $50,000 to $70,000 a year. It's very interesting that in Alabama and Mississippi, where they really scared out so many immigrant workers with crackdowns on undocumented immigrants, they couldn't find people to pick the crops.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't find native-born Americans to do that kind of stoop labor. Now, that's certainly not for $50,000 a year. However many jobs there are available out there, the ratio of job seekers to number of jobs is what counts. And that's been running about, you know, it depends on your the area of the country, from 5 to 1 to job seekers per job available to 8 or so.
Here's an email from Peter in Madison. Your guest's concerns are valid, but I am concerned about her threat to vote non-Obama in the next presidential election over his lack of perfection. Progressives should never forget Bush, the wars, repression, and recession that resulted from disaffected progressives' votes for Ralph Nader in 2000.
Yes, I know. It's very, very hard. I just came back from a brief trip to Spain, where I had a chance to meet with some of the people from the movement there, their equivalent to our Occupy movement, which is the they call it the 15M movement for the 15th of May, when it started this year, and they. You know, they say they're not going to vote. They're not encouraging people to vote.
Really?
Although it will mean, you know, that it's very likely that the socialist government, which has not been very socialist, will fall and the right wing will take over. And they said, yes, we're criticized for this. But look, Zapatero, their so-called socialist prime minister, what good was he? You know, like we have had these socialist heads of state like Papandreou in Greece, Zapatero in Spain, whose whole function has been to preside over austerity measures which are making people's lives miserable. And those austerity measures came because of the gambling of the guys at the top.
Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest this hour, journalist, author. Written some marvelous books, including Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream, and more. And she's been extensively involved in blogging, writing about the Occupy movement, not only in this country, but all over the world. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the Elizabethan drama Anonymous. I just saw the film last Friday, which is beautifully done, but I can't believe they got all these great Shakespearean actors to really seriously consider consider the question of whether or not Shakespeare was Shakespeare. At any rate, we will be talking with William Shakespeare. He won't be available, but Jonathan Hobrosh teaches English at Pace University, and he says Shakespeare was Shakespeare. We'll have some fun. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest. Taylor in Rustford, Minnesota. Hi.
Yeah. Just wanted to what your guest thought about a lot of the Occupy protesters being Ron Paul supporters. And Ron Paul has been warning us of this economic downturn, the housing bubble, and stuff like that for 8, 10, 12 years. And people are still saying, oh, the guy's crazy.
Are the people Ron Paul supporters that you've been running into, Barbara?
No. Though certainly there are such people at occupation encampments. But I think what's striking to me is the absence of references to politicians, to political, to elected officials. You don't see signs saying Obama or Ron Paul, or whether they're making demands of those figures or praising them or whatever. It's just, it's really not of great interest. Ron Paul is not the only one, by the way, who warned about the housing bubble. I think that what's going on is there is a real disillusionment with our elected officials.
It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Taylor, thanks very much for the call. We go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. The man who lives on $3,000 a year, he cuts firewood to keep warm. Where does he burn that firewood, and where does he cut it? He must have land. He has to have somewhere to live to produce his agriculture. He's not just living on $3,000 a year. There must be something more to the story than just $3,000. You can't live in the park and cut down the wood in the park.
Yeah, he's gone now, probably out cutting wood. But it was an extreme thing. Most people can't live that way. Thanks, Diane, for your call. Doug in Mount Horeb. Hi, Doug.
Hi, great show. Two comments. One is I'd like to compliment your guest on that book, How the Bright Side, I forgot the exact title, but Looking at the Bright Side is Ruining Us. It's a great book. But the comment I wanted to make was I have a cure for your pessimism. I want to recommend to you and everybody actually listening to this show, go to YouTube and watch a movie that's there called Money, Power, Fast Cars, and Fancy Women. It's 9 minutes. It's Money, Power, Fast Cars, and Fancy Women. There's 500 pictures on that video, and they go by really fast in 9 minutes. And they're contrasting pictures. When you look at it, you get all kinds of things like a firefighter, and then the firefighter's running into a building, and the next thing you see is somebody sitting on a yacht drinking wine. And then you get a picture of a rich woman shopping on Rodeo Drive with a white purse, and the next thing you see is that same white purse hanging in a bomber in the cockpit of a plane piloted by a woman. And you get a picture of a Vietnam vet homeless on the street crying, and the next thing you see is a picture of a corporate mansion owned by a banker where they're just eating caviar and drinking wine. There's 500 pictures that go by like that, and it's very inspiring and motivating. And I think anybody who's feeling bad about the possibility of doing something, if you sit there and look at that for 9 minutes, if that doesn't get you out of your chair and out in the street, I don't know what will. So,
is that what it did to you, out of your
Absolutely.
Chair?
Absolutely.
It did, really?
Money, power, fast cars, and fancy women.
Have you seen it, Barbara?
No, but I'm going to, on Doug's recommendation.
I'm sure others will. Thanks, Doug, very much for the call. What do you think is going to happen in Ohio today?
With the election?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was out of the country for a week, and I missed what is happening.
All right, well, you'll be tuning into it. It's a big vote on that issue, too, whether or not union rights will
yes.
be stripped.
Oh, yeah. Right, with the public sector unions.
Right.
Have the right to bargain, to
yeah.
exist, really.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting response, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Doug, thanks very much for your call. We go next to Pam on the road. Hi, Pam.
Hi. You guys, thanks for the conversation this morning. I'm an international management consultant with a perspective on why Obama hasn't been on the phone to a bunch of mayors to say, you know, get this fixed. I've been in this business for 25 years, and there's been a generational change from leadership to management. And Obama, unfortunately, has been raised in the school of management. He used hope as a tactic for his campaign, but once he's been in office, he thought if he just moved the numbers around and fixed the problem, that was his job. And then he speaks to the public as you would to analysts at a Wall Street conference call. He recently had a Jimmy Carter moment when he said, that used to be us. You don't give the public, as a leader, you don't give the public the diagnosis. You give them the prognosis and the way through it. And he just doesn't know how.
Huh. That's an interesting comment. You don't give them the diagnosis, you give them the prognosis. Barbara?
No, I think that's Pam's comment is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of it that way. It's a question of, management. And I think a lot of our politicians, some of the ones who are quite often even liberal, have tended to see their job as just managing rather than leading, rather than being in touch with people, rather than listening. You know, if Obama, for example, in recent years, instead of surrounding himself with Wall Street guys and CEOs to make economic decisions, if he brought in laid off workers, people, school teachers, people like that, it would be a whole different story. And to me, that would be leadership, not just thinking, oh, well, I'm just a technocrat just managing things.
Thanks, Pam. Sean in Green Bay. Hi, Sean.
Good morning. Thanks for the discussion. Great discussion. I'd like to express my concern about the protesters not focusing more on campaign finance reform. I think that's really the root cause of a lot of the issues that's going on, and I'd like to get your thoughts.
I agree with you, Sean, that is so central, that is so important. But we haven't seen it get too far in the last 10 years or so. And it's the think for a lot of people, maybe the younger ones especially, there is an impatience with that idea of slow technical reform. They're saying, I don't know, what I'm going to be doing to pay my rent next month. I don't know what I'm going to be, how I'm going to afford medical care for my children. And you talk to me about campaign finance reform, fine. But we have to, right now, dramatize in every way possible what this current system, this corrupt system, as I call it, is doing to the American people.
Thank you, Sean, for the call. Do you and others, Barbara, run the risk of making this movement larger than it is, that indeed it may just be a very small group of very committed people, and we have to pay attention to them, but they don't represent the vast majority?
Well, but they have the support of the majority. I mean, that's what's so striking in recent polls, that over 50% say they sympathize with occupiers, something like 25%, I don't remember the exact number, say they sympathize with the Tea Party. So something is happening here. I just see the support in the most surprising places, just talking to people randomly. And not that's simply anecdotal, but I think that's what's so surprising about it.
Something's happening here. What it is ain't entirely clear, or wherever that one goes. Gerard in La Crescent, hi. We have about a minute and a half left. Hi.
I just have a quick question. You had mentioned that this Occupy Wall Street gives you hope, and I would just like for you to just simply clarify why.
Well, for years I have been following, poverty, seeing it rise in this country, seeing it getting harder, seeing a war against the poor rather than efforts to help them, and seeing the middle class erode, and wondering all the time, when are people going to say enough? When are people going to stand up? for their rights. And, you know, what gives me hope is that I see people doing that now.
Thank you, Gerard, very much for the call. And your son has been, your son is a writer. Your son must give you hope, too. I know you've written about him lately. Is he involved in the Occupy movement?
My son, Ben Ehrenreich, whose new novel, Ether, is now out, I should mention, lives in L.A., where he has, you know, been spent quite a lot of time at the occupation site and has been doing some writing about it. But, you know, I don't know, and everybody in my extended family is very supportive. A nephew has been, you know, sleeping out in the cold in Fort Wayne, Indiana. So, something's happening here.
Well, they all know you, too, right? They've been influenced by Barbara Ehrenreich. Yeah. Barbara, thank you ever so much for being with us. I really enjoyed the hour.
Well, my pleasure. I like talking to people.
Barbara Ehrenreich, our guest this hour, journalist who's been writing a whole lot, and you can find her blog. She's writing a lot about what the whole Occupy movement means. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And I do want to tell you, she mentioned poverty and has written extensively about poverty. Tomorrow, we are going to look at poverty in the largest city in the state of Wisconsin, which is Milwaukee, which is where we are, and we'll be examining that.